With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And I got really bored, fed the ducks one day, and had a semi-frozen loaf of bread because I hadn't thawed out the bread. And I remember just throwing this bread in the duck pond, and it hit a duck. And I saw the duck's leg kind of move, and I didn't stay to see what happened because I thought, I've killed a duck, right? I need to go back to work, or I need to do something. This is how I got into writing, by killing a duck.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi. And today, I want to introduce this podcast with a quote from my guest's latest book, The Language of Kindness. Come with me on the wards from birth to death, past the special care baby unit and the double doors to the medical ward. Run through the corridors to answer the crash bleep, past the pharmacy and staff kitchen, and to the accident and emergency room. We explore the hospital itself, as well as nursing in many of its aspects. What I thought nursing involved when I started, chemistry, biology, physics, pharmacology, and anatomy. And what I now know to be the truth of nursing, philosophy, psychology, art, ethics, and politics. We will meet people on the way, patients, relatives, and staff, people you may recognize already, because we are all nursed at some point in our lives. We are all nurses. Christy Watson is a best-selling author with a specialist interest in nursing and mental health, having spent 20 years working as a nurse in the NHS. She holds an honorary Doctor of Letters for her contribution to nursing and the arts. She's a patron of the Royal College of Nursing Foundation, and her non-fiction work, The Language of Kindness, published in 2018, was a number one Sunday Times bestseller. It was Book of the Year, The Evening Standard, The New Statesman, The Times, The Guardian, The Sunday Times. It's been translated into 23 languages and spent 5 months in the Sunday Times top bestseller list, with good reason. We're taking a slight turn from our usual chat about nutrition and lifestyle to talk about this fascinating and as important topic that impacts our well-being to the very core. Kindness. We have a candid chat about stress, burnout, depression, the politics around the NHS. It's a real different chat that we're having today, but I think you will find it absolutely fascinating and useful as well. Christy Watson is a force of nature. I'm so glad our paths crossed, and I'm sure they will cross again. She's already doing another piece of non-fiction work that is going to dive deeper into the aspects of social care that are impacting primary and secondary care. And although it does seem a bit doom and gloom sometimes as we're having this conversation, I think people like Christy Watson, who don't shy away from the facts are super important for the alleviation of a system that is overburdened at this point in time. You can find the recipe that I cooked for Christy, the aubergine curry, on my YouTube channel, The Doctor's Kitchen, and you can subscribe to the newsletter where we give science-based recipes every single week. Give this a 5-star rating if you loved it. But for now, on to the podcast. So you said that you like, don't have any dietaries and you like spicy food. So I thought, okay, fine, I'll make you a curry and I'll make you something inspired by what I try and tell the healthcare staff at my hospital, what to eat and big batch foods that you can bring for lunch the next day and that kind of stuff. But then I realized it's 9:30 in the morning and I'm making you a curry, but you don't mind that. So I'm making you an aubergine and lentil curry. We've got fennel seeds, some fennugreek seeds, black mustard, seeds and some cumin as well, some garam masala, some tomato puree here, and this is canned tomatoes, coriander. These are some lentils that I've just got from a can, but you can make them yourself just by cooking them for about 20 minutes or so. Just some like standard grey lentil, green speckled lentils. And then this aubergine, all I've done is cube them and then roasted them dry with no oil.
Oh, really?
Just to sort of dry them out for 20 minutes in a hot oven, and that's it. And that's a really good hack. I always have, like, you know, steamed potatoes in my fridge, or, you know, cooked butternut squash, so you can quickly throw them into curries and dishes just to bulk them up a bit more. We're going to start off with the holy trio: ginger, garlic, and onion. Indian cooking and lots of different cuisines, actually, even, you know, like French and. So we're going to go for that. And yeah, hopefully it's going to be delicious.
I'm sure it will be.
So
I'm holding you to account.
Yeah, for sure. So this isn't like an odd question for me to ask you, because after having read your book, I feel like I know so much about you and your background and how you grew up and stuff. But just for the listening audience that perhaps haven't come across you before, which is very hard not to because you're a Sunday Times bestselling author and you're incredible, give us an introduction into you and how you started on your journey.
Where do I start? So I didn't ever want to be a nurse. I was one of those really precocious, flighty teenagers who went through every career idea known to man.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a jazz trumpeter, an astronomer, a lawyer, a dentist at one stage, everything I could possibly think of. And I even went to agricultural school, actually, to become a farmer. Because I was really interested in, I suppose, animals and farms, even though I grew up on a council estate in Stevenage. So I'd never even been to a farm kind of thing. The only animals I'd seen were pigeons. So I had this romantic...
How do you think about the farming?
I just romanticised and fantasised about everything. So I imagined sitting in the sunshine and eating cheese and pickle sandwiches, and that must be what farming is like, right? Yeah. So I went off to agricultural college and found out it really is not like that at all. So I left within 2 weeks. And then I think my parents by that point were so exasperated with me. They'd bought me some quite expensive farming stuff, like rubber sole boots and stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah, that I begged them for, because I said, this is it. This is my final decision. I was definitely going to be a farmer.
So super expensive wellies and stuff.
Super expensive coats, super expensive wellies. We didn't have any money. You know, so I was really adamant that this is what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And so when I left farming after 2 weeks, I think they were just so tired of me.
Yeah.
And I was tired of myself. And I just sort of fell into nursing. I didn't have anything to do, so I went to volunteer. And for the first time ever, I was around these nurses.
Yeah.
And I just remember being in total awe of what they were doing.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to describe in a way how much I admired them, because I really did straight away. And I thought, I wonder if that's something I could do. Told my parents, and my dad actually laughed out loud when I said, I think I'm going to be a nurse.
Really?
Yeah, I just don't think he could picture me being a nurse at all.
Could he picture you being a farmer?
I just don't know. I think by then they'd had enough.
Yeah.
They were lovely and they just had enough. But so I went off to nursing school at 17. And pretty much loved it straight away. I did find out during my first week that I'm scared of the sight of blood.
Yes, ideal, I remember that in your book. Yeah.
So I fainted when I had a blood test, which is, again, but I was so determined by then that this career would stick.
Because you were quite an activist when you were younger, right? You were quite open-minded and you were vegetarian, I think, at one point.
I was vegetarian. Veganism wasn't really in then, but I would have been vegan, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you sort of had that sort of mindset, right? Like, you know, feeling good and...
Yeah, I was really into animals, really into animals. And I suppose I was quite political. If there was a march, I'd be on it.
Yeah,
if there was something going on, then I always wore those badges. And I was quite an angry teenager, about the world.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd have been around now, I'd have been on every march.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be outside number 10 today.
So
I was that sort of person. And yeah, it was, nursing was really great because I could channel that activism into helping people.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good way of describing it, I think, channeling that activism, because, you know, they are essentially the unsung heroes of the NHS, and I think there's a lot more recognition for them now. And I think your book really heightened that massively, because I remember you saying in a couple of interviews, there hasn't been a biographical book written by a nurse since Florence Nightingale, is that right?
Yeah, well, I when I had the idea to write the book, and I'd written two fiction novels before this, but it didn't occur to me to write non-fiction, and it certainly didn't occur to me to write about nursing at all. And I went to the library to see what kind of books there were out there, and I'd always loved medical narrative non-fiction. Mm-hmm. You should write some, Rupi. But I've always loved it, and I think my favourite writer of all time is Oliver Sacks. And so I've always read the kind of philosophical musings of doctors about what it means to be a doctor, but never thought, hang on a minute, I could do the same about nursing. And I went to the library to look what's out there, and there was shelves and shelves and a whole genre of medical fiction written by doctors celebrating what it means to be a doctor, but nothing by nurses, except Florence Nightingale's notes on nursing.
So was that the catalyst for you to be like, okay, now, because at that point you'd written two books, right? You'd written two novels. How on earth did you get into that, first of all?
So I was on maternity leave, actually, when I started writing, and I was really bored. I was so bored. I probably shouldn't say this because it's not something mothers should say, but I was so bored. And maybe it's because I'd been nursing my whole life. You know, I was 100%. A senior sister in paediatric intensive care.
Yeah,
I was used to really, really busy long days, and my daughter just slept. And I remember
there's so many mothers like, I wish my daughter was asleep. I wish my child was asleep.
She slept all the time, but I took her to feed the ducks. And the other thing is that you kind of fantasize, or at least I did, when you're on maternity leave, that there's going to be this whole gang of really cool moms that you're going to hang around with. And I just didn't know any or find them until much later. And so it was kind of just me and her and some, you know, people just wandering around the park. And and I got really bored, fed the ducks one day, and had a semi-frozen loaf of bread because I hadn't thawed out the bread. And I remember just throwing this bread in the duck pond, and it hit a duck. And I saw the duck's leg kind of move, and I didn't stay to see what happened because I thought, I've killed a duck, right? I need to go back to work, or I need to do something. This is how I got into writing, by killing a duck.
I wasn't expecting.
I know. Well, I haven't thought about this for a long time, but it was killing the duck that propelled me to do something. And my poor daughter just needed me to be out of the house, I think. So I went and did it.
She must have been scarred for life after she witnessed her mother kill a duck.
She's vegan.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, there you go. She's explains vegan. A lot.
I went to do a creative writing course, a short course at the Mary Ward Centre, which is next to Great Ormond Street, actually.
Okay, yeah.
And it's like an evening class. Uh-huh. And it was a beginner's creative writing course, really mixed bag group of people.
Uh-huh.
And I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the short story that I wrote was the first creative writing I'd ever done, really. And it went on to become Tiny Sunbirds Far Away, which is my novel.
Yeah, which I have to admit, I haven't read, actually. But it's definitely on the reading list for me.
It was fun writing. It was so much fun writing creatively. Yeah. And I went off and did an MA then at University of East Anglia in creative writing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I carried on nursing at the same time. So that's how I got into writing, by killing a duck. It's a long story. It's true.
That's brilliant. No, that's really good. And you were managing your career at that time, you know, being a parent, being a nurse, exploring a new career all simultaneously. How on earth did you keep up with all that kind of stuff? What was your sort of coping mechanism?
I look back and think I was working silly hours in all of the things.
Yeah.
But I think that was probably the happiest year of my life when I was doing the MA, because I just loved everything I was doing so much and I was passionate about it. And yeah, it just felt such a privilege to be able to not only find one job that I completely love, but two jobs that I really loved. And then also to parent this great little girl. So it never felt like a hardship. It never felt like, oh gosh, I've got to go to work, the Sunday night blues. Yeah. I've never had that. And I feel really blessed to be able to not have ever had that.
Yeah. Actually, one of my...
You're probably the same.
I'm similar in that. I was going to say, one of my best mates from Australia, he loves going to work. He gets there early. He meditates now for like 5 minutes before going to his shift, because he works in A&E, so it's a high-pressure environment. And he just loves that feeling, that smell, as soon as you get onto the ward, the busyness of it. Yeah, the smell. Yeah, like that sort of... distinctive clean smell. Sometimes not always clean, but that distinctive smell that you have when you walk onto an A&E ward. And it's I have that sort of thing now, that I'm able to marry my clinical work with all the other stuff I'm doing outside it. But I think I went through a period of time where I was just facing, and I'm sure every NHS worker has gone through this, where I just faced complete burnout, where I lost affection for the job, and I kind of lost a bit of empathy, I think. Simultaneously.
Yeah.
I want to talk, we're getting into this a bit early, but I think it's a good point to talk about it now. Cause
I'm not crying because you're making me emotional.
No,
it's the onions. Although you are making me emotional, and I do feel empathy for you. It was at that moment that a small tear came out, and I didn't want you to think, wow, she's so empathetic.
I mean, you're super empathetic. I wasn't expecting that, Christy, but yeah. I wanted to talk about it because at one point in your book, I think you described something like that, where you're working and you had a few issues. I think you were just had a few personal issues, and you lost the love of the job, which you reignited a bit later.
Yeah,
with a beautiful story as well. But yeah.
No, I am really crying now. Yeah. No, I'm not. It's so tricky, isn't it? Because it's such a complicated issue, burnout or compassion fatigue or depression, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, compassion fatigue, that's a...
Yeah. I think, I do wonder whether burnout is just a term that we hide behind with language as medical professionals, because we don't want to say that we're depressed. And I think that's a bit problematic. But I certainly felt depressed or burnt out or compassion fatigued or whatever you want to call it. And that was partly because of the job and the pressures of the job and the longevity of it. Because you do, after so many years, start absorbing everyone else's grief and trauma. In the same way that if you work in infectious diseases, for example, you're risking infection every day. If you work in A&E or critical care, you're absorbing some of the most significant moments of people's lives, and quite often they're horrific. So that accumulates over time. And I definitely felt that alongside personal issues is the thing that was the trigger for me. And I spent a good, I suppose, couple of months feeling numb. I remember being unable to cry, which is really worrying. It's a real clinical marker of serious issues. And then this little girl that I was looking after, I've called her Charlotte in the book, and everyone's got different names. She came in with sepsis, and she had three nurses to look after her, just her, that she was that sick. So she was probably the sickest kid I've ever looked after. She had meningococcal sepsis, and she had a pH of 6.8 or something. I mean, everything was incompatible with life. Yeah. We didn't think she'd have any chance of survival whatsoever. And actually, she lost her limbs, but she did survive. And she came back into the hospital sometime later onto prosthetic limbs with her mum, and was back, you know, just a normal young child who was laughing and smiling and full of life and full of joy. And I remember thinking at that time, this is for me the thing that prevents or protects me from burnout. It's those moments when you think people's will to survive at all costs, particularly children, I think they've got this incredible capacity to head to survival no matter what and find joy no matter what. And I sort of, she helped me recover. Yeah, so that was quite a powerful thing. And that you always, I think, get the most from your patients. That they're the people that, because whenever I'm asked about burnout or the job or the pressures of the job, it's never the patients that are the pressures of the job. Mm. It's the system, it's the organisation, it's the staffing, it's the politics. Mm. But it's never the patients. Mm. The patients are the ones that actually help keep you going, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Like purely from a managerial point of view, and I hate to just put everything on the managers and everything else, but the way the system is run is the most frustrating thing about the NHS and the thing that gives me the most anxiety about it as well. And it's the threat to the survival. It's actually, we like to hide behind the fact that, you know, we have an aging population, we have higher patient footfall, and yes, all those things are true, but purely if it was run a lot more efficiently, which it has the capacity to do so, we would be able to cope, I think. Because we're already coping right now with a broken system. So, yeah. And I think...
What would you do to...
What would I do? Yeah. So I'm really lucky.
Before you ask me.
No, don't worry. I'm not going to ask you. It's an impossible question to answer. Yeah. And I get asked this a lot.
I do as well, yeah.
And I'm just like, what do you expect? I'm just cooking food. Like, you know, trying to get people to think about their self-care a bit more. It's a very emotional topic, which is why you're crying still.
Yeah.
But
I can cry.
Yeah. So I'm really fortunate to be part of the Clinical Entrepreneurship Programme, which is run by Innovations, NHS Innovations with Professor Tony Young. And it really gives me a lot of hope, because we are given insight into the most entrepreneurial people in the NHS. We have a staff of over 1 million people, and there is so much ingenuity in that staff base because these are people on the front line who know exactly what it's like to work in the system, have thought laterally about how it can be improved, and are actually doing things and coming up with innovation. So a friend of mine has come up with this, it's an app where it allows you within 15 seconds to take a picture of a non-clinical issue that is slowing down your clinical time. So a broken light bulb, or the infectious, the blood culture bottles that have run out again on ward 3. You know, those little things, they build up, and they're the reason why we are slowed down, and the reason why we have frustration and all that kind of stuff. Because otherwise, generally what happens is you go and ask the HCA or the nurse, like, where is it? And it's not their responsibility. Whose responsibility is it?
So. Yeah. Now, I met a nurse recently, and speaking of those small innovations that make a massive difference, I mean, they happen all over the NHS. But so many people doing such great work, despite all the pressures.
Yeah.
And she was working in a homeless hostel. She was a parish nurse in Dundee, working in a homeless hostel, and spent the day with her. Mm. And she was described to me as the kindest nurse in Britain.
Really?
And I totally agree. I just fell in love with her straight away.
Yeah.
Because those people, she just, you know, this was a room full of people who had all kinds of issues. Some of them bounced in and out of prison. Some of them were on remands. Everyone had substance abuse issues. They had long-term mental health problems. And she just put the karaoke on, said, if you have time, if you're busy judging these people, you don't have time to love them. And she really did love them. But what she'd done in an innovation way is she had made a street map of Dundee, and she'd given them an actual physical map and shown the times and the points where they could get dental treatment, where they could get food, where they could get the lunch, whatever it was. This hostel will accept you at night on this night. And it was just a map, and it had made so much difference to these people's lives.
Yeah.
And she was a band five, she's a band five nurse in Dundee that we don't hear about. Yeah. And what I'd love to see is these things being, you know, these people being championed, and also the linking up, so that that can happen all over the country, so that people's voices are not so quiet, they're actually listened to, rather than the sort of bombastic political voices that we hear. we should be listening to those people, like you said, the frontline staff who are on the ground having great ideas.
Exactly, yes. And I think that's what you did so well in your book, because you married like the brutality and the real sort of nuts and bolts of clinical medicine with the softer, as important touch of kindness that is usually on behalf of the nursing staff. And I think it's that kind of marriage of accepting it's not just all, you know, medications and interventions and surgery and all that kind of stuff. There is a huge underside to the NHS that is the reason why we're getting people better. It's kindness.
Yeah, I think so. And this smells amazing, by the way. Right. It smells so good. And my eyes have stopped watering now. Yeah. So don't say anything sad because I'll look mean. we'll probably talk a lot about the patient population and the state of the world and society, really. But the medical model that we've lived by for so long and revered, it's not cutting it. Uh-huh. We know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because people come in with problems that technology and drugs, not always, but mostly, particularly in primary care, they're coming in with problems that technology and drugs are not going to be able to help at all. And people are suffering with political anxiety, all kinds of mental and physical health problems. They've got so many comorbidities. I think the National Health Service, somebody once described to me as, oh, it's become the National Illness Service, but I disagree. I think it's the National Suffering Service now.
Right.
And how do you alleviate suffering? Well, you don't do it with medicine.
Yeah.
Well, not the traditional model of medicine that we've seen.
Yeah.
You do it with kindness, you do it with food, you do it with information, being able to make people understand their own problems and issues and having the confidence to be able to do something about it.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think it's almost like we need to redefine exactly what we mean by medicine.
Yeah.
Because I think there's the assumption that when we say medicine, we mean drugs. We mean the hard sort of cold interventions, treatments, imaging, surgery, all that kind of stuff. Whereas actually food, exercise, sleep, listening to someone, caring for some, touch. I remember you talked about skin hunger in your book, which I think is a real interesting phenomena that we can improve people's blood pressure, heart rate variability, heart rate, just by giving them a physical touch. It's incredible. And I think, we just need to be a lot more accepting of that. I think, we are making small strides. Social prescribing is a big sort of buzzword at the moment, particularly in the Royal College of GPs.
Yeah.
And I think we're getting better at recognising that, it has a role in medicine.
But our government's getting better at recognising that.
I think so. And I think it's purely, I think it's from like patient demand, but also people who work in the NHS demanding it themselves. And when you experience what it's like to be a patient, you empathise a lot more with the person in front of you. And I think that was my misfortunate and fortunate experience when I was at Basildon University Hospital and I was I got ill myself and I had atrial fibrillation because I experienced what it was like to be a patient very early on, and that sort of experience has never left me, and that's perhaps why I ended up cooking people and telling people what to eat for a living.
That's good though, isn't it?
Okay, I've made you this curry.
Okay,
it's aubergine lentil curry with, I've just topped it off with some coriander and we've got a whole bunch of spices in there. It'll all be on the show notes. Let me give you a spoon so you can try this. And you can give me your honest opinion as well.
Don't worry, I will.
There you go.
No, it looks amazing.
You're brutally honest. There you go. And there's a little bit of rice there that I've just... made before, so...
It's a bit boiling hot, so I might... Oh,
yeah, no worries. Yeah. Just take your time.
Smells so good.
Yeah.
I think maybe you should be prescribed on the NHS, Rupi. Just outsourced.
Yeah.
Feeling a bit down.
Yeah.
Just come round.
Yeah. Do you want to know my friend? She was recently featured in the Scottish Herald because she started taking patients to the supermarket herself.
I saw that.
You see it?
Incredible.
Yeah, she's great.
That's what we need more of. This is so good.
Good.
Do you ever take the nurse's food?
I have done, yeah. So I've got a nurse, her name's Ruth. I hope she doesn't mind mentioning her. But she always does tea time at 4 p.m. always in urgent care. And we always go there. And it's usually biscuits. And she looks at me and she's like, I'm really sorry, Rupi. I'm really sorry. I'm like, listen, it's fine. You're comforting. It's, you know, it's more than the macronutrient composition of the food that you're giving. It's the fact that you're giving everyone love and you're sharing it. Mm-hmm. So yes, we can tweak it. We can add some more nuts and seeds and dry fruits and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the very act of what you're doing and making it regimented, I think is, it's more than the food. So.
This is so good.
Good.
And
I'm
yeah,
so
love
Ruth.
I worked in a neonatal intensive care ward once. Uh-huh. And the same thing, at 4 o'clock in the morning, no matter what was happening,
There
was a buffet. And a proper buffet, sausage rolls, vol au vent. And it was actually really good for our mental health as a team.
Yeah,
and it didn't do any harm to the patients. It was great for them, actually, because it meant that we were all ready to go and blood sugar was fine.
Yeah.
Probably too high.
Yeah, probably too high. I remember this one nurse, actually, in A&E in Mona Vale in Australia. Mm. Oh, God, I forget her name now. It was a few years ago. But she often worked the night shift. And every night shift, she would literally come with a cheese platter. And I kid you not, it was 4 a.m, we're sat behind the A&E desk, and the doctors, and we've got all the little crackers and cheese. It was so, like, sophisticated.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to enjoy this. So not everyone's looking at you whilst you eat this.
Or hearing me crunch.
Yeah, hearing crunch.
Yeah, there's a lot of food questions I've got for you as well.
Oh, yeah, go for it. If you want to ask me food questions, I'm all
in. Because I was thinking earlier, I was thinking about particularly when we were talking about the kind of patients that we're seeing in hospital and primary care.
Yeah.
And people with, for example, really serious long-term mental health conditions. And... my fear is that the very people who need your advice the most are the people that are going to be unable to access it.
Yeah.
They're not going to pick up a cookbook. They're not going to make the lentils.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to do any of that. They're certainly not going to access a device and an app because they won't have one. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is, how do we get the message about food and the importance of it to the people who need that message the most? Because the wellness industry, the people that have taken it on board, it's fantastic and it's great. But these are the people I would suggest who've got mild issues, if any, and not serious long-term problems that we see day after day.
Yeah, totally. And I grapple with that realization all the time. Mm. And I suppose I'm still very much on this journey of like, okay, so I started this social media account and that's given me a platform and it allows me to do a bit of TV and sell some books and all the rest of it. And it's slowly filtering out the message that hopefully gets to people who perhaps wouldn't naturally gravitate to looking at an account full of food imagery online. However, I think the bigger play for me to get to that exact patient population that you're referring to, i.e. the most vulnerable, the most in need, is via Culinary Medicine, which is the non-profit teaching doctors and medical students. Because in that course, what we do module by module is teach them how they can, A, engage patients in front of them who may not even know where they're going to be sleeping in the next couple of weeks, who have a history of abuse, who have weight issues that they won't even have realized is related to whatever other condition they have. Mm. That's how we really filter down the information taking them on a journey from, okay, so you're having cornflakes and grab and go Greg's Bakery items every single day. Can we just change one thing? Can we reduce your Coke consumption from 3 to 2 a day? Can we change the amount of crap beef that you put into your lasagna by half and then add maybe some plant-based proteins into it that's just as cheap, if not cheaper, than the meat alternative. Those little incremental changes are going to be the most effective. And it's something I was telling you about earlier about the sort of digital product that I'm in the process of creating. That the sole aim of that is to increase the fruit and veg consumption of people, which averages around 3 to 4 or 5 a day. And that small change at scale is going to be hopefully ground changing for public health. So that's what I'm, so this is like a bigger plan.
That's great to hear. It's so good to hear. And particularly if you can get involved with policy and hospital food. Yeah. And because if you're working on an individual level, it is difficult to to get to the people who are the most vulnerable.
Totally.
But it, like you said, if you work in a much broader sense, then filtering it out is going to be easier.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the way I come about it is that it's all great, like having an Instagram account and beautiful images and all the rest of it. And it gets the message out in some way. However, there's 4 million people still using food banks in the UK, which is an abomination. There are people who don't have cooking appliances in their home. A lot of people rely on microwaves and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we actually geared a couple of modules in culinary medicine to people who have to rely on canned food. So how can you make a meal with a can of chickpeas or a can of asparagus spears or peas or something like that? And actually you can make some healthy alternatives. So it's about teaching people that, those like basic skills, because otherwise it's incredibly difficult to get to those people.
And what about getting to nurses and doctors?
I feel like you're in.
I love this.
This is great.
No,
go for it.
What about getting, because nurses have got really difficult lives at the moment, and they're working harder than they've ever worked before. Yeah. And people are so stressed, and the staffing is so horrific that nobody has time to drink water, let alone eat. You know, there's a big campaign, remember to drink water. If you're having to remind someone to drink water, that's a step away from addressing what they've got in their lunchbox. How do you support your colleagues with healthy eating decisions? And I mean colleagues, sort of not your immediate colleagues, but the whole of the NHS.
Absolutely. And I remember that you mentioned that in your book. I remember about how people time when they, nursing staff in particular, time when they drink according to when they feel that they're going to be able to have a toilet break, which is just crazy, just madness, absolute madness. And I'm lucky I'm not in that situation. I don't think any of the staff that the hospital that I work are in that situation. But so to answer your question, just last week, I did a staff wellbeing session, half an hour before work, with all the staff. So it was majority nurses, some HCAs and some doctors attended. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the basics of nutrition, which is very hard to cover in about 15 minutes. And then also self-care regime. So how I, you know, make sure that I've got breakfast ready that's not gonna be too time consuming, and it's gonna allow me to work 5-6 hours straight without having to rely on snacks and stuff, which I think we're all guilty of doing, like eating on the go and stuff. So like I taught them a whole bunch of recipes, like overnight oats, tray bakes, things that take less than 20 minutes to cook in a single pan, things that you can have for your lunch the next day. Mm-hmm. But also combining that with the appreciation that it's beyond just food. It's about sense of purpose, about community, it's about movement, it's about improving your sleep hygiene, and just the awareness, even if you don't change anything, I think just the awareness actually does change things physiologically in your your body as well. On the grander scale, hopefully my hospital is commissioning some videos and stuff that might be able to go into sort of will be distributed across like rural College of Nursing networks and certainly the GP networks and that kind of stuff. And then we're also going to be doing culinary medicine modules online for doctors, nurses, dentists, hopefully as far reaching as possible, admin staff, physios, everyone that works in the NHS environment. So there's just grander awareness. And I can imagine this time where in the future, when you're looking after someone and you know, offering them empathy, discussing, you know, their livelihoods and what their aspirations are. You're also feeding them sort of like lifestyle advice as well as that, you know, like what are you going to eat when you go home? Is it going to be tea and toast, or are you going to try and get some more nutrient dense vegetables? What things do you like? Like how can we improve your diet? That incrementally as well.
I think nurses have always done that, and health promotion has always been such a huge part of nursing, whether you're in a third level PICU or whether you're in primary care, whatever. But people are so stretched.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether academically, intellectually, the people that you're teaching in terms of the nurses and doctors know all of this and absolutely want to take it on board. But I remember myself many days when it's 5 p.m. and I realize I haven't eaten at all. And so I just dive into the Quality Street box and there's only the red ones left ever. But it is really difficult, and I think it's great what you're doing, but I do think that, you know, sometimes it's the political system behind it that's causing the issues, not necessarily people's knowledge. And it's that time.
I appreciate that, definitely. I would also take the opinion that a lot of people, certainly from my personal experience in healthcare positions, haven't got the faintest clue about nutrition.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so not necessarily. My experience is mainly from general practitioners and doctors. But man, some of the stuff I've come across from other physicians, it's just like, no, you can't be telling patients that, or you can't be, you know, telling everyone to go low carb, or you can't be saying that, you know, just eat whatever you want. It doesn't have any impact on your health, on your health outcomes. So I think there's like extremes, and I think perhaps it's my own bias that, you know, I wasn't taught nutrition at medical school, and you know, we get on average less than 5 hours at medical school.
Really?
Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah, and that's like a verified fact. I think that was distributed by the GMC or the MSC, the Medical School Council, and they recognise that the variability in nutrition training goes from I think a maximum of 8 to 10 hours to zero. Like, it's literally in the paper. Like, some medical schools give zero. And so that has to change.
Yeah,
and I think that explains a lot of what I see, at least anecdotally, on the front line of people's nutrition knowledge.
Is there a generational aspect to this?
I think so.
Because I'm thinking particularly of an older doctor who I know, who I won't name, who was having a sort of mini stroke, so a transient ischemic attack, and said, pass me the decent Chianti, I'll just drink my way through it. Ended up fine, and it's all a happy tale, a happy ending, but I don't imagine a younger person would have tried to drink their way through a stroke, particularly a doctor. And I think there is this kind of old school, and I sit between them, I guess, because I'm 42, so I'm kind of on the peripheries of both. But there is this old school attitude, in a way, that it's almost... it's almost not as important as people think.
Yes, yeah.
And that's going to change, I suppose, as the next generation of doctors and nurses come through.
Yeah.
Who are much more interested in holistic health, I think, in terms of medicine.
And I think that's either, like we said earlier, based on the fact that more and more people are experienced to getting sick themselves, or close family members.
Yeah.
And patient voices as well. Patients are demanding more than the medicines, I say that quote unquote, that we have traditionally offered, and they're demanding more because it's beyond just pills and surgical interventions.
Yeah, and there is something philosophical about the control that you're giving somebody, because people are so out of control, feel so out of control with the state of the world and the level of hatred that we're all suffering, and the division and the isolationism and the loneliness and the lack of community, lack of kindness and all those things, that if you say to somebody, well, there's no tablet for this, but I'm going to teach you how to do the food, and that's going to make you feel so much better, and they believe that it will make them feel better, that's such a powerful thing, because then they have some control into their illness or their state. It might not even be their illness, their state of living, I suppose. And having that thought that you can do something yourself that's going to help yourself, then I think at the moment that's a really powerful force.
I think it's incredibly powerful. Giving someone the acknowledgement that this is within your locus of control, it's very, very, it's a very interesting psychological state. And it's something that I experienced when I was having my paroxysmal atrial fibrillation episodes. Being a 24-year-old with no triggers, with no pre-existing history, it was so frustrating to not understand why this was happening. All the electrophysiology studies were negative. All my blood tests were negative. There was nothing that modern medicine could explain to me, let alone treatment is one side. There was definitely a treatment for it. But explaining the root cause of it was so, so frustrating. And then when I started taking a step back and looking at, okay, what are the other factors that could be impacting my symptoms? Stress, poor sleep, poor diet, my psychological state at that point in time, being thrust into a junior doctor environment, you know, being in a constant state of like imposter syndrome I felt at the time when I was, you know, junior doctor, not having that much clinical experience. You know, all these things had an impact, and they clearly had an impact, because now I've been able to put myself in remission using a whole bunch of other lifestyle techniques. And yeah, that, and that is very powerful itself. Yeah. Just knowing that, okay, there's something inside me that I can control.
Mm. And maybe it's the feeling of control that's put you in remission.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's loads of ways in which I try and retrospectively figure out what exactly happened. You know, was it my microbiota? Did I change some electrolyte imbalance that wasn't picked up by traditional blood test? Was it omega-3? Was it my stress state? The reality of it is that it's a holistic sort of change that has changed multiple different things.
Yeah.
And this is, it's very hard to put that into a soundbite, right?
Yeah.
It's not something I try and attempt to do, because it's trivializing what is a very complex picture of,
yeah, definitely,
of medicine.
And whatever happens, you will live a much better and longer life because of it. So
exactly.
It's going to have a great outcome, yeah. Great side effect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, what's the downside?
Wonderful side effect.
Yeah. And let's talk about you. Yeah. So, when I was reading it, The Language of Kindness, I thought it was a heart-wrenching, honest account of what it's like to be an NHS worker with the right smattering of political insight and the right tone as well, that kind of gave us a hint of like, oh, look at the bigger picture here and look at what this story is on the front line. Was that intentional? Was that something that you intended to do, or did it just come out in your writing where you're trying to do a story and then actually, you know, let me just give people some insight here into why this might be happening?
I wanted it to be story and storytelling. And you can't tell stories about the NHS without politics. Mm. They just happen naturally. So I didn't go in heavy-handed and think, I want to write a political non-fiction book. I wrote a book about a nurse, about me nursing. But of course, the politics is the backdrop for that. So you don't need to add any, because it's just there. You can't, it's impossible to not be political when, yeah, you're writing about the NHS. I think that, and I'm writing another book at the moment, which is probably even more political, because again, it's impossible to be less political at the moment.
Yeah, yeah,
becoming, yeah, more and more political.
Everyone is being shoved into,
everyone,
that.
Everyone, like, is in that space, more, whether more you want to be or not. Yeah, mm,
absolutely.
But no, I wanted it to be about story and storytelling, and not just my own, but other people's experience of illness and health and what it means to be human, I guess.
And I did notice that you didn't stray away from some pretty hard-hitting, brutal topics that I think, unless you were like a hardened NHS nurse, no one else would have had the confidence to talk about. So in particular, I remember your story about the patient you named Derek, and how that, how you weaved in statistics about schizophrenia and those who are more likely at risk of mental health issues, those who are more likely to be institutionalized are from the minority ethnic groups, and how you started realizing when you're in a fast food restaurant or who the cleaner was at the British Library and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really brave of you to talk about that, because like I said, I don't think anyone else would have had the confidence unless having had the experience as an NHS nurse in the inner city London.
I think it was my experience as an NHS nurse. And the NHS is one of those brilliant organisations that the staff members reflect the population. So it is so diverse, yeah, within the NHS.
Yeah.
And when you go into other organisations, you're like, oh my gosh, everyone's a straight white man.
Yeah.
What's going on? So it's beautiful. That's, yeah, a really beautiful thing about the NHS.
Yeah.
But I felt a responsibility as a nurse to be able to highlight inequalities, astounding inequalities in healthcare. Mm. But also, I have two children and my children are black.
Yeah.
So I'm raising a black son in this society. And so I suppose that in the background of my own personal life was a huge factor to start thinking about these really important issues that we should all be talking about and not shying away from.
Yeah.
And we will get it wrong talking about it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it.
I really commend you, because I think that appreciation for the fact that you will be called out. Some people will say some people will have a willful misinterpretation of the point of view you're trying to paint.
Absolutely. And it's about being aware of my own privilege. Mm. It's about constantly questioning my own privilege. Yeah. And then a willingness to be vulnerable and to say, I will get things wrong. Mm-hmm. And I need to listen and learn every time I do. But it doesn't mean I'm going to stop talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And there was a bit in the book, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, about where you felt like you lost empathy. And then you talk about Charlotte, the little girl who comes back after her meningococcal sepsis episode. What other things do you think that people have in their toolbox of self-care, particularly nurses, that they can use to sort of support them on that journey? Because I think everyone has that burnout or stress or really hiding anxiety and depression and low mood.
I think the main thing that helps nurses, and I'm sure doctors are the same and other healthcare professionals, is the team. Mm-hmm. And your colleagues, because they really truly understand, in a way that maybe your friends outside medicine don't, what a bad day looks like. So you say, I've had a bad day at the office, to someone you work with, they really know what you mean.
Yeah.
And just having that understanding and that teamwork and that framework around you is just crucial for your own mental health and getting through those really difficult times. I think for me, that's the most important thing. Obviously having the support of friends and family, but I think the teamwork is the thing.
Yeah. Do you think... and this is me playing devil's advocate here, because I have a lot of friends who are not in medicine. And when they describe to me what a bad day at work looks like for them, I'm in my head, and I don't vocalise this anymore because I know not to. I learned the hard way, essentially. But we're at risk of like putting the sort of morbidity of our day-to-day lives at the forefront without really recognising that stress is relative to the person in front of you.
It's a really important thing that I'm constantly aware of. I used to be really bad at it, and like you, I've learned to keep my mouth shut. A couple of things about that. So I remember when friends were starting to have babies, and they were really so anxious and calling me all the time because the baby was crying. Yeah. And I remember saying to one friend, if the baby's crying, then they're fine. Because if they're really sick, they won't cry.
Yeah.
And she was so traumatized by that information. Yeah, and of course, for me, that was just a natural thing to say.
Yeah, it's a
really
nurse,
sick babies like... don't cry.
Yeah.
And she was just so, so anxious. So I really didn't help that situation at all. And it is relative.
Yeah.
The other thing is that my children, their dad is a consultant intensivist. I'm a PICU nurse. They have never been to the GP. They desperately want to go to the GP. They see it as this sort of mythical land of unicorns. If I had said to them, I'm spending the morning with a doctor who's a GP-trained doctor, they would just be wanting to come.
No way. I should have brought them along.
They are desperate. And so they are never ill, because my definition of illness is very different from a layperson's definition of illness. So.
Yeah.
And their dad's even more so.
Yeah.
You know, if their pupils react, they're probably fine. So the children of nurses and the children of medics, I think, are a special, special tough lot, because they have to be.
Yeah.
And they certainly seem to be, touch wood, never really ill. They don't have coughs, colds, anything like that. And if they do, they don't mention it.
Yeah.
Because there's no sympathy.
Well, we've probably been sharing micros with them that you've essentially developed over the last like 20 years of being a nurse. So I can imagine.
But I know what you mean about the sympathy. And it's really, now I try and take a step back and realise that everything is completely relative. And people's worries are completely legitimate, and they don't understand. And most people don't want to know really what happens in an accident in an emergency department or in hospital with really, really sick people. Because why would you want to live with that knowledge every day of our vulnerability and our frailty as human beings? Mm. Knowing what could happen is a terrible gift as well as a great one.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I think we were talking about earlier about like everyone living in this existential crisis where I feel certainly that what I'm seeing coming in both primary care and to an extent A&E as well are manifestations of our poor mental health.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Stress is a very, I don't like using the word stress because I think it's just too broad a term.
Yeah.
But for want of a better term, stress is certainly something that's underlying a lot of what I see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if you really want to see the state of the nation in 2019, go and visit a paediatric ward. Because when I started as a paediatric nurse in 1998, whatever it was, a long time ago, it was babies who'd come in with asthma, happy wheezers, give them a nebulizer, pretty much they'd go home. And then someone might come in with one comorbidity, one, treat them with technology or medicine, and then they go home. Now, paediatric wards are absolutely choco full of children who've self-harmed, suffering their first psychotic episode, who have tried to take their life, and who've also got 17 physical comorbidities at the same time. Yeah. And it's just unbelievable. And this is the spillover from the fact that we don't have enough mental health beds by a million miles. And so and everybody now is increasingly, I think, suffering so many serious mental health problems, particularly young people, that we're only just at the beginning of recognizing and understanding it. Yeah. And when I say mental health problems, I think that we're in a great movement of anti-stigma and talking. We've got some great celebrity endorsers of the wellness movement and all these things which are incredible. Yeah. But the mental health disorders that I've seen are catatonic patients who've spent 20 years unable to use the toilet because they cannot move, or who are jumping off the roof of buildings. So, properly serious stuff that we don't really highlight. And the money from the mental health pot is all the same pot. Mm. And so I do worry a little bit about the ethics of where we are in terms of mental health care in the country.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like an investment in mental health services is an investment in our ability to look after our societies.
Yeah.
The investment in people, even just the act of listening to people's worries and concerns, or, you know, exploring the history of whatever that might be, a very colourful history, that is something that I've noticed in general practice is hugely, hugely lacking. The number of people that I've tried to refer to CAMHS, the number of people that are waiting to speak to a counsellor, the number of people, you know, that I know have a stress-related issue, but just, you know, don't have a psychologist to get them to speak to. And then, you know, the GP becomes the Swiss Army knife of everything. We're dealing with the back pain, we're dealing with psychiatry issues, we're dealing with, you know, people that should perhaps be in hospital, but we're dealing with them in the community because we just can't send them.
And that person's at risk.
Yeah.
And so the stress of that on the doctor, knowing that that person is at risk, you're going home and not sleeping and thinking that is someone that could take their own life tonight and they're on a waiting list for 18 months.
Yeah.
So it's really, we're in a really bad state. And this is not just UK, this is across the world. This is a global issue now in the West.
In the West,
yeah. Interestingly. Yeah. So, this is a much wider talk.
It's almost like what I'm seeing in developing nations or developed nations like India and China is the double burden of disease. So you're getting the affluent middle classes that are now suffering from diseases of Western living because we aspire to have our KFC and McDonald's and all the rest of it. Yeah. And, you know, driving cars and working sedentary lifestyles. Uh-huh. But it's interesting just to segue into how in your book you actually bring up a whole bunch of, it was like reading a history book at some points.
No, honestly,
it was brilliant. It was just the right amount of historical sort of, you know, you talked about Florence Nightingale, you talked about the inception of nursing, but you also talk about Ayurvedic traditions, you talk about Chinese medicine.
Yeah.
Is that something that you took an interest in at an early stage, or was it something that you realised after having been a nurse for so long that it was kind of instilled in your profession without labelling it as something like ancient medicine?
I think my thinking has shifted with the patients that we're seeing. So we need something else now. We need something new. So we're not necessarily suffering just with Western problems anymore. We're suffering with world issues. And so our thinking needs to change. And we've been so focused on our own system of what we think is right and what we think is helpful that we're living in this multicultural society and we're saying we're going to impose our system on you. It might not work for that particular person. I had a patient once who was suffering with very severe depression and kept talking about the ants crawling in his head because he had no word for depression in his language. There wasn't a word for it. So I think we do need to start thinking about much more globally about medicine that
potentially can help our human condition and not necessarily medicine that's going to cure traditional diseases. Because we don't suffer so much with traditional disease. Yeah. Or we do, but it's changing and it's shifting.
Yeah, one of the things I look out for in A&E, obviously excluding organic causes, all over body pain. Mm. And it's usually that, you know, matriarchal Indian mother who comes in, who's had all over body pain for so long and it's got worse.
Yeah.
And you dig a little bit deeper, hopefully without the family in the room and stuff. And then you realize there's a lot of stuff. It's definitely like, you know, type 2 diabetes, and I hate to generalize, but high blood pressure and all the rest of the things in their medical history. But there's so many other things, so many other layers of psychological involvement going on in that presentation.
Yeah,
something that I
do. You ask, have you got all over body pain?
No.
If someone it's almost like asking a child, does your tummy hurt, but does your head hurt? And they say yes.
Yes.
And so you sometimes put ideas into people's psyche. No,
I'm very careful about the language I use, because I know people can latch on to symptoms.
And is that why GPs now say, well, what do you think the problem is? And patients say, well, you're the doctor. Surely you can tell me. But is that why?
It's such a loaded question. I mean, like, I asked that question, but I feel like I'm very junior. I've only been a general practitioner now, fully qualified for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I'm learning every step of the way, as I'm sure everyone is, even, you know, my bosses have been consultants for decades. Which patient to ask certain questions to.
Right.
So, there were certain patients that I wouldn't even think to ask that question to, because it's kind of like, well, they're coming from a cultural background that expects the doctor to prescribe them a pill or prescribe them something. Whereas other people would enjoy the inquisition about what they think is going on.
Yeah.
And sometimes a very powerful question, very powerful answers that can be delivered to that as well. Like, I think it's, a lot of people admit it's probably stress related. I'm going through a really bad time. I'm going through a divorce, or I'm going through financial issues and that kind of stuff. And then it allows me to explore a lot of things within the 8 minute period that I have with them.
I know, it's shocking, huh?
But
And do people who know they've got bigger issues book triple appointments and things like that? Can I have a quadruple appointment?
So depending on which
a lot going on
practice you work at, yes and no. So when I'm in A&E and I'm working, let's say, in urgent care, I will, and I know that there's some other issues that they need to, I will request that they ask the receptionist to book a double appointment.
Okay.
But it can be, I mean, we're all just super stretched. We only have like 15 slots per morning. And then if you're taking 2 or 3, then that's 2 less patients you can see in that short time.
Do you find as a GP that you're absorbing all the sadness of everyone that must be coming in? Because generally people are sad now, right?
To an extent, yes. However, because I work part-time, so 2 to 3 clinical days per week, I feel I have the right balance to not get too overwhelmed.
Okay.
Whereas when I was training and when I was fully qualified doing 5 days a week, huge, huge burden.
Mm.
You know, I'd go back, being a junior as well, having, you know, not diagnose anything and ask them to come back and like put a treatment plan in order. Was that the right thing? Should I have done this? Should I send them to A&E? Should I have, you know, got them to come in the next day and that kind of stuff? Safety netting is a big thing, but in some cases you can't safety net enough. It's hugely worrying. And it's something that my colleagues who work full-time in general practice, I don't think I could do that now, if I'm honest. And I don't know whether it's something that we should be doing either, with the number of patients that we see per day. And then they're not to trivialize what specialists do, but if you're seeing neurologists and all they see every single day is the post-nephrectomy patients or the renal colic patients, it's all very specialized. They can pattern recognize. With a GP, you're seeing 30 to 40 patients a day physically, with a multitude of different issues that can extend across different specialties. So that is another level of sort of mental burden to take home with at night. And then put onto that, you know, the managerial issues, the bureaucratic issues, the quaff things, and, you know.
Do you think doctors' mental health is suffering like never before?
Oh, massively.
Nurses as well. Female nurses have now got the highest occupational suicide rate. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Because it used to be
That's the Office of National Statistics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's terrifying.
That is terrifying.
It's terrifying. And I think that doctors must be a similar, particularly GPs, I think.
Yeah. Not to think too morbidly about it, but it's kind of like to be expected, right? If you put...
It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be, no. But like if you put people in a situation where they're working plus 12 hours a day, multiple times per week, and with the amount of stress that they have to deal with as well, and all the occupational pressure.
And the society stress, the type of patients that people are seeing. Because it is the loneliness and the suffering is just beyond anything.
And the PTSD and, you know...
Yeah.
I was chatting to a colleague of mine who works in Australia, and I don't mean to sort of like... not what's the opposite of catastrophize, to sort of like
glorify,
yeah, that's the one. I can tell you know the English in creative writing course. I don't mean to glorify like the Australian healthcare system, and they've definitely got issues, and they're actually, I think they're seeing issues related to increasing patient footfall with an inadequate system to cater for it, because they still have inefficiencies that parallel the NHS. But a friend of mine did a really, really bad shift overnight where they had multiple traumas coming in, a couple of junior doctors overnight. And that morning, the hospital had arranged for 3 trained psychologists to come and speak to all the juniors and actually give them a little bit of a debrief.
Yeah.
And the consultant was on the phone at 7 a.m. speaking to individuals as well that were like, you know, he just like, can I just speak to this person? Can I speak to this person? Because they were dealing with multiple traumas and that young people. And it was horrific, horrific. Yeah. But just that realization that people need.
It makes a massive difference.
It's huge.
And I think that's going back to what you were asking me about earlier in terms of what helps you not have burnout.
Yeah.
And particularly, I hate... nostalgia, because half of the time you think the things that were good never existed anyway. But there's a brilliant Welsh word called hiriaeth, and means looking back to something that never actually existed with joy or whatever.
What was the Welsh word?
Hiriaeth.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
I love that, because my nan's Welsh. But we used to all of us go out regularly, and there was such a huge, diverse, multicultural, multi-system, lack of hierarchy support network. We'd all go to the pub after a terrible day, from the chaplain to the cleaner to the consultant to the nurses.
Amazing.
And having that was really amazing. And of course, people don't do that now because they've got no money and nobody's got any time, and nurses are working other jobs, and everyone's exhausted. And the other thing is the lack of firms for medics. And not having those mentors and not having the seniority that you can go to and say, look, I've just done this terrible thing. And them saying, it's okay, it's not as bad as you think or whatever. Mm. But that doesn't happen. That's kind of infrastructure, and the support system doesn't really happen so much anymore. You might be going from somewhere every 6 months and new faces. And it's really tricky.
Do you think that is a particular issue when it comes to hospital environments in inner city environments like Birmingham or... Manchester and London in particular, and it happens less so, and there's more of that sort of sense of community in DGHs around the UK?
I think so. Think it's there is such a fast, high turnover of staff, but people don't have money. Student nurses now, they don't have a bursary at all, so they're working maybe 3 jobs on top of their studies, so nobody's socialising really. Nobody's got time or energy.
You need to incentivize the occupation that really looks after the most vulnerable. In fact, that brings me back to a quote that you talked about in your book, the Mahatma Gandhi quote, the way we treat our most vulnerable is a measure of society. And if that is so, and you add, the act of nursing itself is a measure of our humanity.
Mm. And how we treat our nurses is a measure of our humanity.
Absolutely.
Surely we've got homeless nurses who are going to food banks, and we're in dire straits.
That's crazy.
Yeah. We've got a highest occupational suicide rate is female nurses. Then we're in big trouble.
Yeah.
And we know we're in big trouble. And while all this braying is going on in Westminster and all this political maneuvering, people are dying. We know that. We see it every day.
Tell me a bit more about your new book. I'm fascinated by what you're working on right now, because if there's anything as impactful as your last one, it's going to be incredible.
So it's a way off. It's not going to be coming out for a while because I've only just written a first draft. And as you know from first drafts, it's pretty rough around the
7%,
edges.
8% rewrite.
100 rewrites later. Yeah. But it's very much, it's more stories about being a nurse and more stories from my own life. But also I wanted to come outside the hospital doors because most of the NHS is outside the hospital doors and it's nursing. A lot of nursing is done outside uniform, outside the hospital. And it's maybe what people don't really understand about nursing and medicine. And people look at the NHS and they imagine a city hospital. And of course, that's not it at all.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to describe the cobweb of healthcare that runs through the country and how it works. And I've been traveling in the country, but also outside the country, just to look at nursing, particularly in different places like prisons, hostels, homeless care centres, school nursing, district nursing, everything that I can imagine that's outside, because I think that by talking about those things, it gives us a lens into where we are as a society, because those are the people who are working with quite often our most vulnerable people. So it's back to the quote.
Yeah.
Well, if how we measure our society is by how we treat our most vulnerable, and our most vulnerable don't have a voice at all, and we only hear from those people who are shouting and who are powerful, then how can we measure our society?
Yeah.
So in order to do that, I hope I've given a voice to people that maybe didn't have a voice.
Absolutely. And when are you going to make a TV program out of this?
Because
I can so see this as a TV program. Like, I want to visualize it as well as read it, obviously. I want to visualize it.
Well, kindness is I'm working with Mammoth Productions on making a TV program for kindness.
Fantastic.
And that's just ongoing, and it's really TV World is quite, I mean, you've got links with TV World, you know about this.
It's
a very strange place. It's very odd. It's very exciting.
It's exciting. It's flaky. It's
I didn't say that.
My experience has definitely been that it's very fast paced. It's under threat, I would say, with the likes of traditional sort of channeling.
Oh, okay.
I think it's under threat, but they're finding like more innovative ways of promoting content. I mean, I never used to watch TV, right? I don't have a TV in my flat. But given that I have a laptop, you know, I can watch TV, and that, so I've started watching Netflix a lot more than I used to and stuff. In the name of research sometimes, when I'm watching medical programs, nutrition stuff.
Yeah, no, it's very addictive. And I think so many teenagers now, we worry about young people's mental health, and then they sit in their room for 12 hours binging Netflix every day with the curtains shut. And we wonder why things are bad.
Yeah.
But Netflix is a drug for sure.
Yeah.
And I'm signed up, you know, I love it as well. It's very addictive.
Yeah.
And it's very isolating.
Yeah.
Because you're just there on your own watching a TV show. And then when you do see other people, you talk about the TV show that you've watched because you've done anything else. But yeah, I love it. I do love it. But I do worry about how much TV everyone's watching.
Yeah.
And also, like you said, people watch on the laptops and YouTube as well. YouTube or Netflix is what people tend to watch. Totally, I mean, my kids will wait till something comes to Netflix rather than watch it on traditional channels, even if they can get it on iPlayer.
Really?
They will wait till it comes to Netflix. It's like a branding thing for them as well.
Oh, wow.
It's really strange.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
I've noticed actually over the last 10 years that the staff com room has completely changed to one where there used to be a lot more interaction verbally, to one where you go on your break and you're looking at your screen and you're eating and you're watching your screen. And I'm making more of a conscious effort to put my phone away because I'm guilty of that just as much as anyone else. And then to strike up conversation with random people, whether it be, you know, the cleaning staff or the HGAs or other doctors and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's different, isn't it?
Yeah, you must have witnessed that over the...
Oh, when I started, we had a smoking room.
Oh!
I swear to God, this place was yellow.
Not just in the mental health units.
No, it's the staff.
Wow.
So, and I'm not that old, you know? And it was at the back of the canteen, and you go in, and it was like Ronnie Scott's.
Oh, my God.
Late at night, you go...
No way.
And the staff used to sit there, the relatives, the patients, and the walls. If you'd got a knife on the walls, you would have scraped off some nicotine.
Oh, my God.
At actually scraped it off. So, I mean, that's not that long ago.
No.
And so we chatted because we were just in the smoking room. Yeah. And then that changed. And then I suppose the staff room was always, wherever I've worked, the staff room hasn't been great, I have to say. Yeah. Like really shabby.
Yeah.
And quite dirty and like cups left everywhere. And always industrial sized fridges with, do not touch my food.
Do not touch
me. And I know who you are. Yeah. But yeah, it's it would be, I suppose, again, it's about investing in staff and investing in people, and it's about time and money and where do those priorities go. But I think you cannot care for people unless you're cared for yourself.
Totally.
And so so those investments, and not just kind of random things, like I saw recently on a staff room wall, it said, wellness plan, sign up for yoga on Tuesday afternoons. Mm-hmm. And it was a sign up sheet for all the staff. And somebody had written, I didn't pee for 12 hours yesterday. Namaste.
Yeah.
I was like, there are big, unless you address the big issues, you can't get to the smaller things.
Absolutely.
But I'm glad the smoking room's not.
Yeah, definitely.
You'd have died. You'd have died. That was bad.
I thoroughly enjoyed chatting to Christy, and the rawness and the passion which she brings to her writing as well as how she speaks, I just think is so commendable. Please do pick up a copy of the book, The Language of Kindness. Check out Christy online at Tiny Sunbird. That's on Twitter. Instagram, it's Christy Watson Writer, and check out the website christywatsonauthor.co.uk. I know she's going to have loads of TV and media stuff coming up, so keep an eye out for her. I can't wait for Language of Kindness to be a motion picture, or at least a series online, because I just think it's going to be so hard-hitting, and it just tells the truth of what it's like to be a healthcare practitioner in the NHS, particularly in inner city areas. You can find all of this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com. Subscribe to the newsletter for weekly based recipes, content, and much more to help you live the healthiest, happiest life. Give us a 5-star rating. If you love this podcast, it really helps spread and share the message. Tweet us at doctors_kitchen. Check out the Instagram, YouTube, and of course, don't forget to order a copy of either of my two books, The Doctor's Kitchen and Eat to Beat Illness. I will see you next time, guys.